But for Kagawa Prefecture, the program was usually held on an island. According to the local news reports he'd seen, of course, in each case, the location would only be announced after the game was over. Every game in Kagawa took place on an island. This time was no exception. Sakamochi didn't mention the name of the island, but once Shuya checked its shape on the map, he might be able to tell. Or maybe a building would reveal the name of the island. The soft breeze blew in. He could smell the sea. It was cold for a May evening, but not unbearable. He'd have to be careful when he slept not to tire himself from exposure. But first, there was no one. There weren't any soldiers, but Shuya was disappointed to find none of his classmates there. As Sakamochi had anticipated, everyone was hiding out. Even Hiroki Sugimura wasn't there. Only the soft breeze carrying the smell of the sea came drifting across the athletic field. Damn it. Shuya grimaced. If we scatter like this, we'll fall into the government's trap. It might be all right if you were forming groups with your friends. Sakura Ogawa and Kazuhiko Yamamoto might be meeting somewhere. Likewise, Kazuo Kiriyama's gang. But anyone hiding alone would eventually have to confront someone. Who knew what would result from that kind of chaos? Wasn't chaos essential to the progress of the game? Well, I'm going to wait here for the others. First, I have to wait for Noriko. Shuya glanced back at the dark interior of the school building. They were told anyone loitering in the hall would be immediately shot. But the soldiers in the room at the end of the corridor didn't pay any particular attention to Shuya. They weren't exactly chatting up a storm. They just sat around, unarmed. Shuya licked his lips and decided it was best for him to move away from the door. He looked outside again. That was when he noticed it. He didn't see it last time because he was too preoccupied with the overall view. But this time he saw something that looked like a garbage bag lying at his feet. Shuya wondered whether it was someone's day pack, dropped by accident. But then his eyes widened. It wasn't a garbage bag, nor was it someone's day pack. There was hair growing out of one end. Human hair. It was a human being, wearing a sailor suit school uniform. The body was in a V-shape, lying on its side, face down. The ponytail tied with a wide ribbon looked familiar. No wonder. He'd just seen her off only 3 minutes ago. The stiff body belonged to female student number 14, Mayumi Tendo. Right beside her lobster-shaped braided hair, a dull, silver, 20-centimeter-long stick protruded from the back of her uniform. Diagonally, like a transistor radio antenna. There were four tiny flaps resembling a fighter plane's tail at the end of the stick. What the hell is this? What he should have done was immediately seek cover. Instead, Shuya stood there, stunned. He recalled Sakamochi's reply to Kiriyama when he asked when the game began. As soon as you leave here. It was unbelievable. Who could have done this? Did someone return to kill Mayumi Tendo just as she left the school? Shuya stopped speculating and cautiously crouched down and checked the premises. There was no sign of the attacker. No arrows had flown at him when he'd been standing in a daze. Why? Satisfied with killing only Mayumi Tendo, did the assailant leave the premises? Or was this some engineered provocation? Did the soldiers at the end of the hall kill her to convince everyone that some of their classmates were already willing to play the game? But if that were the case... All of a sudden, Shuya realized Mayumi Tendo might still be alive. She might be unconscious from the shock of her wound. In any case, he should look at her. If he hadn't felt something odd and restrained himself from taking a step forward, a split second later Shuya would have dropped out of the game early. In other words, a silver object whizzed right by Shuya's eyes. Yes, it came directly down from above. Another antenna was planted in the ground. Shuya shuddered. If he hadn't been standing at the exit, waiting for Noriko, he would have been immediately shot down. The assailant was on top of the building. Shuya clenched his teeth, snatched up the silver bolt, and ran to his left. He moved impulsively but in an erratic way to elude the assailant.
He turned around and looked up. Under the dim moonlit sky, a large, dark shadow loomed above the gabled roof of the single-story school building.
Could that be not Shogo? He had no time to think. The shadow pointed its weapon at him. Just to surprise him, Shuya threw the bolt at the shadow. But thanks to Shuya's gifts as a star shortstop, the bolt flew at incredible speed and traced a fine arc right at the shadow. The shadow groaned, held its face, hunched over, and then began to sway. Then it fell. Shuya stepped back and watched the shadow fall from a height of at least 3 meters and land with a thud on the ground. The object in the assailant's hand fell with a metallic crash. Light leaked through the building exit. The large shadow was lying face down, wearing a school uniform. It was Yoshio Akamatsu. He was motionless now, perhaps because he was unconscious. His weapon, a crossbow,
was lying by his hand.
The day pack that had fallen by Yoshio's feet was half open. Shuya saw a stack of silver bolts inside. Shuya felt a sudden chill. It was true. He was participating. Yoshio Akamatsu was in on this game. Yoshio had taken his weapon, returned here, and killed Mayumi Tendo. Someone was coming from behind. Shuya turned around. It was Noriko, who had taken the situation in as she held her breath in surprise. Shuya's eyes went from Noriko's face to Mayumi Tendo. He ran over to Mayumi and touched her neck to check her pulse. She was dead. There was no doubt. His brain felt like a fuse fizzling out. Others might be in the same state of mind as Yoshio, and one of them might just suddenly return, this time, perhaps, with a gun. Shuya had no choice but to change his attitude toward the game now. So this was it. When Sakamochi said, "As soon as you leave here," this was what he'd meant. Shuya stood up and ran to Noriko. He took her by the hand. "We're running. Do your best. You have to run." Shuya began running, half-dragging the injured, limping Noriko. Which way, though? He couldn't afford to deliberate over his decisions. He headed toward the grove. First they'd hide in the grove. Then they could... No. He dismissed the thought. Given Noriko's condition, they were defenseless against any attack. Staying near the school was too dangerous. Waiting in front of the building for the others was completely out of the question. He rushed Noriko, and they entered the grove. Tall trees mixed in with short trees, and the ground was covered with ferns. Shuya turned to yell some warning to the remaining 11 students coming out. In their class of 21 pairs of boys and girls, there should have been 12 students following Shuya's and Noriko's seat numbers, but Fumio Fujiyoshi had to be counted out. But he quickly reconsidered. Shuya reached the somewhat forced conclusion that his classmates probably weren't as foolish as he was, so they'd flee the moment they emerged from the building anyway, especially once they saw Mayumi Tendo's corpse. For a moment he thought of Shinji Mamura, but he gave up on this idea too. Once again, he convinced himself that there had to be some other strategy, another way for them to meet up. In any case, they had to leave. Holding Noriko Nakagawa tightly, he haphazardly led their way into the grove. A bird cried out, "Caw, caw," ruffled its wings, and flew away. He couldn't see it, but it didn't matter. He had no time to observe it anyway. 39 students remaining. Chapter 8. Yoshio Akamatsu regained consciousness almost immediately, but because he'd been knocked out cold by the blow to his head, he felt as if he were coming out of a deep slumber. He first noticed how his head was throbbing. He felt out of it. What was it? Was it from playing video games yesterday way past midnight, which meant that yesterday was Saturday, or was it Sunday? Then today must be Monday, which means I have to be in school. But what time could it be? It's still dark. Maybe I can sleep a little more. As he sat up, the sky and earth rotating 90 degrees, an empty field unexpectedly spread out in front of him. There was a mountain beyond the field, shaped like a bow and darker than the night sky. All of a sudden, everything came back. Sakamochi, Mr. Hayashida's corpse, Yoshio's departure, discovering the crossbow in his day pack once he found shelter in a small shack, his returning here and observing Takako Chigusa, female student number 13, whose face was a little severe but beautiful, looking tense as the track team's best runner dashed away at full speed. Him struggling up the thin steel ladder by the side of the building in order to reach the roof. Then how, due to the trouble he had loading his bowgun with a bolt, Sho Tsukioka, male student number 14, also managed to escape his reach. And then, Yoshio turned around and saw the girl in the sailor suit uniform lying there. It didn't exactly come as a surprise to Yoshio. What he felt now wasn't guilt over killing one of his classmates so much as it was fear. It might have resembled a gigantic billboard sign standing in the middle of a wasteland inside his mind. On the sign were letters in blood that read, "I'm going to kill you." In the background, all his classmates held weapons like axes and pistols, attacking Yoshio, who stood in front of the sign as if it were a 3D movie. Of course killing your classmates was wrong, and once the game time expired, they were all going to die anyway, so it might be absurd to fight at all. But that was just too rational. The fact was that Yoshio simply did not want to die. He was petrified by any of his classmates who'd bare their teeth at him. Just think about it. You're surrounded by a swarm of assassins. And so his choice to reduce the numbers of the enemy as efficiently as possible wasn't motivated by rational thoughts, but instead by a deeper, primal fear of death. There was no need to discern your allies from your enemies. Everyone had to be an enemy. After all, when Ruhei Sasagawa used to pick on him, everyone looked the other way. Yoshio scrambled to his feet. First, Shuya Nanahara, who'd been in front of him. Where did he go? The crossbow. I have to get the crossbow. Where did it... Yoshio felt a blow against his neck as if he were struck by a club. He fell forward with a thud. His body twisted into the shape of a V, and his face scraped against the moist soil. The skin of his forehead and cheeks peeled away, but this no longer mattered to him. He was already dead by the time he had fallen. The same kind of silver bolt with which he had shot Mayumi Tendo was now planted in the back of his neck. 38 students remaining. Chapter 9. Kazushi Niida, male student number 16, emerged from the building 2 minutes after Noriko Nakagawa. He stood at the exit for a while, shaking. The crossbow lying next to Yoshio Akamatsu's body was still loaded with a bolt. Although Kazushi had picked it up, he had no intention of shooting Yoshio. But the moment Yoshio stood up, he reflexively pulled the trigger. Kazushi did his best to overcome his panic. The first thing was to get out of here. That was the priority. What he should have done in the first place was ignore Yoshio Akamatsu and Mayumi Tendo completely and run away. Given the circumstances, he had no other choice but to kill Yoshio. Yoshio Akamatsu had obviously killed Mayumi Tendo, so Kazushi hadn't done anything wrong. Kazushi was very good at making excuses. Once he'd justified his action, the numbness in his head began to wane. As he lowered the crossbow, he automatically grabbed Yoshio's day pack, which was loaded with bolts. Right before he moved on, he stopped and picked up Mayumi Tendo's day pack too. Then he hurried off. 38 students remaining. Chapter 10. Had they been running for 10 minutes now? With his arms still wrapped around Noriko, he signaled they should be still, and they both stopped. Under the hazy moonlight shining through the branches overhead, Noriko looked up at him. Their heavy breathing echoed like a giant wall of sound, but Shuya tried his best to listen beyond the wall for other sounds in the area enveloped in darkness. No one seemed to be chasing them. They were too short of breath to sigh, but they could relax a little now. As he dropped his bags, a sharp pain ran through his right shoulder. He was in poor shape. An electric guitar was heavier than a bat, but it wasn't something you swung around. After putting the bags down, he placed his hands on his thighs and tried to rest. Shuya urged Noriko to sit in the dark grove. After he checked again for any suspicious sounds, he sat down next to her. The thick grass underneath them made a crunching sound. He felt that they'd covered a good distance, but given how they'd been zigzagging, and how they'd lost all sense of direction climbing the mountain, they might have only been a few hundred meters away from the school. At least the light leaking out of the building was no longer visible. This might have been due to the thickness of the grove, or the gentle slopes, though. Anyway, it felt safer deep inside the dark grove. His decision was impulsive, but he was certain it was safer than the wide-open seaside. Shuya looked over at Noriko and whispered, "Are you all right?" Noriko murmured, "Yes." She nodded slightly. Shuya felt the urge to stay here for a while, but that wasn't an option. First, he opened up the daypack. He dug into it, groping around, and found an object that felt like a bottle of water. Shuya pulled it out. The sheath felt like leather, and a leather grip poked out of it. It was an army knife. Sakamochi had said that the daypack was equipped with a weapon. Was this it? He searched the bag a little more, but nothing else inside resembled a weapon. Only a bag that seemed to contain bread and a flashlight. He unfastened the sheath and removed the knife. The blade was approximately 15 centimeters long, and after checking it, he returned it to the sheath and tucked it under his school uniform belt. He unfastened the lowest button on his uniform to make the grip immediately accessible. Shuya grabbed Noriko's daypack and opened the zipper. He knew he wasn't supposed to go through a girl's things, but Noriko didn't pack this bag. He found something strange. It was a curved stick approximately 40 centimeters long. It had the texture of smooth, hard wood. Was this what they called a boomerang? A weapon used for fighting and hunting in primitive tribes. An aboriginal village hunting hero might be able to knock down an ailing, sluggish kangaroo with this thing, but what use could it possibly have for them? Shuya sighed and returned it to Noriko's daypack. "You want some water?" Shuya asked. Noriko nodded and said, "Just a little." Shuya took out the plastic bottle from his daypack, broke the seal of the twist-off top, and sniffed the contents. He spilled some on his hand and licked it cautiously. Then, after taking a sip, making sure he had no abnormal reaction, he handed it over to Noriko. Noriko took the bottle and only swallowed a small mouthful. She probably knew that water was precious. Each bottle only contained approximately 1 liter, and they'd only have two. Sakamochi said they had no access to telephones, but what about the water system? "Let me take a look at your leg." Noriko nodded to Shuya's request and stretched out her right leg, which had been tucked under her skirt. Shuya took out the flashlight from his daypack. He cupped it carefully with the palm of his hand to prevent its light from leaking out and pointed it at her leg wound. The wound was on the outer calf, a section of flesh approximately 4 centimeters long and 1 centimeter deep had been scraped off. A thin stream of blood still flowed out of the ends of the pinkish flesh wound. It looked like she needed stitches. Shuya quickly turned off his flashlight and grabbed his sports bag instead of his daypack. He grabbed the bourbon flask and 2 clean bandanas he'd packed for the trip. He uncapped the flask. "This is going to hurt." "I'll be okay," Noriko said. But once Shuya tilted the flask and poured the bourbon to disinfect her wound, she let out a small hiss. Shuya pressed 1 folded bandana onto her wound. He opened up the other one, folded it lengthwise, then wrapped it around her leg tightly like a bandage. This would stop the bleeding for now. After wrapping her leg, He pulled at both ends of the bandage tightly, tied them together, and mumbled, "Damn." Noriko whispered, "You mean Nobu?" "Yoshitoki, Yoshio, everyone and everything. I'm not into this. I am so not into this." As he moved his hands, Shuya glanced at Noriko. Then he looked down and finished tying his knot. Noriko thanked him and tucked her leg back under her skirt. "So Yoshio was the one who killed..." Her voice was trembling. "Mayumi?" "Yes. He was above the exit door. I threw the bolt at him and he fell." Now that he thought about it, Shuya suddenly realized he hadn't taken care of Yoshio. He instinctively assumed Yoshio would remain unconscious for a while. But for all he knew, Yoshio might have woken up immediately afterwards, which meant he might have taken his crossbow and climbed back up on the roof to continue his slaughter. Was I being too naive again? Should I have just killed him? With this thought, Shuya checked his watch under the moonlight. The old, domestically manufactured Hattori Hanzo limited edition diver's watch, along with most of his belongings, it had been donated to Shuya through the orphanage, read 2:40. Everyone might have left by now. At most, there were only two or three students left, regardless of Yoshio Akamatsu's state. Shinji Mamura had already. Shuya was nearly certain Shinji could easily escape Yoshio. By now he'd already left too. Shuya shook his head. Now he felt foolish believing they could unite against the game. "I never thought someone like him would actually try to kill everyone else to survive. I understand the rules, but I didn't think anyone would actually participate." "You might be wrong about that, though," Noriko said. "Huh?" Shuya looked into Noriko's face, too dark to discern under the moonlight. "You know how Yoshio was always timid? I think he was scared. That must have been it. I mean, you have no idea who might turn against you. He might have been convinced everyone was coming after him. I think he was really scared, and that if he didn't do anything, he would end up being... killed." Shuya sat down against the nearest tree trunk and stretched his legs out. The ones who were terrified might try to kill each other. The same idea had occurred to Shuya, but he had also thought the ones who were scared would basically hide out. But if they were terrified out of their wits, they might actually take the initiative and start the killing. "I get it." "Yes," Noriko nodded. "It's still horrible that he started killing indiscriminately." They remained silent for a while. Then Shuya came up with an idea. "Hey, you think if he'd seen the two of us together, he wouldn't have attacked us? Wouldn't it prove we're not playing the game?" "Well, yes, maybe." Shuya started thinking. If, as Noriko said, Yoshio had just been overwhelmed by paranoia, that moment back there was when he first realized someone was willing to play. That was why he fled. But maybe that was wrong. How could they possibly kill each other? It was outrageous. Then should he have waited for the others, leaving aside what he should have done with Yoshio? Either way, it was too late now. Everyone would be gone by now even if they went back. Besides, did Yoshio do that simply out of fear? He was getting confused. "Hey, Noriko." Noriko lifted her face. "What do you think?" "I fled from the school grounds the moment I realized there might be others like Yoshio. But if he really did it out of fear, in other words, do you really think any of us would actually participate? What I mean is that I'm thinking of gathering everyone together to escape from this game. What do you think?" "Everyone?" Noriko fell silent and tucked her knees under her skirt. Then she said, "Maybe I'm not as generous." "Huh?" "I couldn't handle some of them. I could trust my friends." Noriko offered the name of their class representative, Yuki Utsumi. Shuya had known Yuki since elementary school. "Like Yuki, but I don't think I could trust the other girls. There's no way I could be with them. Don't you think?" I have no idea what was going through Yoshio's mind, but I'm afraid of everyone else too, Noriko said. I mean, I just realized I don't know a thing about everyone else. I don't know what they're really like. I mean, you can't see into someone's mind. I don't know a thing about everyone else. She was right, Shuya thought. What do I know about this group that I spend the day with at school? He suddenly felt like there was an enemy out there. Noriko continued. So I'd be suspicious. Unless it was someone I really trusted, I'd be suspicious of them. I'd be afraid they might want to kill me. Shuya sighed. The game was horrible, but it also seemed flawless. In the end, it was a bad idea to invite everyone indiscriminately to form a group unless you were certain about them. What if, just say what if, they betrayed you? It wasn't just his life he'd be endangering, but Noriko's too. It was only natural the others before him had immediately fled the premises. That was more realistic. Hold on a sec, Shuya said. Noriko glanced up at Shuya. Then that means us being together won't necessarily prove we're harmless. The others might suspect that I plan on killing you eventually. Noriko nodded. Yes, I'll be suspected too, just like you. A classmate might avoid us once they see us together. But I also think anyone we might invite will turn away. I mean, it would depend on each person. It would be scary. Shuya inhaled sharply, then held his breath. Yes, it's really scary. So the ones who fled from the school premises might have been right. But what mattered to him was protecting Noriko Nakagawa, the girl Yoshitoki had adored. Maybe he should have been content with the fact that, at the very least, Noriko was safe by his side for now. He had done the safest thing. But, he said, at the very least I wanted Shinji to join us. I think he'd come up with a really good plan. You'd be okay with Shinji, right? Noriko nodded and said, of course. Given the amount of time she spoke with Shuya at school, she had many occasions to talk to Shinji Momura. Shuya recalled how Shinji had helped her up and how he signaled him to calm down. He realized now that if Shinji hadn't done those things, he and Noriko might have remained dazed and been shot down like Yoshitoki. As if she were thinking along the same lines that led to the inevitable, she looked down and quietly said, "So Nobu's gone." "Yeah," Shuya answered quietly as if it were a questionable fact. "I guess so." Then they fell silent again. They could reminisce, but now was not the time. Besides, Shuya couldn't bring himself to take a stroll down memory lane over Yoshitoki. It was too heavy. "I wonder what we should do." Noriko stiffened her mouth and nodded without a word. "I wonder if there might be a way to gather the ones we trust together." "That's..." Noriko considered it, then became silent once again. It was true. There was no way, at least for now. Shuya sighed deeply once again. He looked up and saw through the twigs the gray night sky dimly glowing under the moonlight. So this was what it meant to be in a no-win situation. If they simply wanted everyone to join, all they had to do was walk around and shout. But that would be an open invitation to get themselves killed by any of their opponents. Of course, he hoped there weren't any opponents. But in the end, he had to admit he was scared. The thought led to an idea, though. Shuya turned to her and asked, "But you're not afraid of me?" "What? Didn't you wonder whether I'd try to kill you?" Under the moonlight, he couldn't see well, but Noriko's eyes seemed to widen a little. "You would never do something so horrible." Shuya thought a little more. Then he said, "But you can't know what someone's thinking. You said so yourself." "No," Noriko shook her head. "I just know that you would never do that." Shuya peered at her. "You can tell?" "Yes, I can. I..." She hesitated. "I've been watching you for so long now." She might have delivered these words more stiffly in a normal situation, or at least one that was a little more romantic. Then Shuya remembered the anonymous love letter he'd received written on light blue stationery. Someone had put it inside his desk one day in April. This wasn't the first love letter the former star shortstop and current self-proclaimed, and sometimes other-proclaimed, rock star of Shuiwa Junior High had received, but it made enough of an impression on Shuya for him to hold on to it. There was a poetic quality to the letter that touched him. Even if it's a lie, even if it's a dream, please turn to me. Your smile on a certain day isn't a lie. It's not a dream. But having it turned to me might be my lie, my dream. But the day you call my name, it won't be a lie. It won't be a dream. And then, it's never been a lie. It's never been a dream that I love you. Had Noriko sent that letter? He remembered observing how the writing resembled hers and how the poetic style seemed similar, too. So then, Shuya thought of asking her about the letter, but decided not to. It wasn't the right time. Besides, he had no right to bring it up. After all, Shuya was so hung up over Kazumi Shintani, who would never, to steal a phrase, turn to him, that other girls and love letters were of little concern. The most important thing now for him was to protect the girl Yoshitoki Kuninobu had wanted so much, not to find out if Noriko had a crush on Shuya Nanahara. Shuya still remembered the bashful look Yoshitoki gave him when they had that talk. "Hey Shuya, I got a crush on someone." Noriko asked him, "What about you, Shuya? Aren't you afraid of me?" "No, wait. Why then did you help me?" "Well?" Shuya thought of telling her about Yoshitoki. "Come on, my best friend had a crush on you. So if I'm going to help anyone, it's got to be you, no matter what. I mean, really, come on." He decided against this too. They were better off discussing this later, when they could take the time, assuming that they would have any time later. "You were injured. I couldn't just leave you alone. And besides, I trust you." "I'll be damned if I didn't trust someone as cute as you." Noriko broke into a slight grin. Shuya did his best to return the smile. They were in a horrible situation, but he felt slight relief in forming a smile. Shuya said, "In any case, we're lucky. At least we're together." Noriko nodded. "Yes." But what were they supposed to do now? Shuya began packing his bag. If they were going to rest in order to come up with a strategy, they needed to find a place that gave them a vantage point from which to see possible opponents. Again, they had no idea what the others were up to. At the very least, they had to be extremely cautious. That was what it meant to be realistic in the face of horrific circumstances. He kept the map, compass, and flashlight by his side. This was the world's worst orienteering game. "Can you still walk?" "I'm all right." "Then let's move on a little more. We have to find a place to rest." 38 students remaining. Chapter 11. Mitsuru Numai, male student number 17, proceeded cautiously between the grove and the narrow moonlit beach. He was carrying his issued day pack and his own bag on his shoulder. He held a small automatic pistol in his right hand. It was a Valtar PPK 9mm. Compared to the other weapons that had been issued in this game, this one ranked high. Along with most of the guns used in this program, this mass-produced model was imported cheaply from third-world countries that had remained neutral toward both the nations of the Republic of Greater East Asia and the American Empire. Mitsuru was familiar with the pellet gun version of the pistol, so he didn't need the accompanying manual. He even knew there was no need to cock the pistol before pulling the trigger. It came with a clip which he'd loaded into the gun the moment he found it at the bottom of his day bag. The gun in his hand made him feel somewhat secure, but he held something even more important in his left hand, the supplied compass. It was the same cheap tin model Shuya had, but it did the job. 40 minutes prior to his departure from the classroom, his great leader, Kazuo Kiriyama, male student number 6, had passed him this note. If we're really on an island, then I'll be waiting at the southern tip. Of course, everyone was an enemy in this game. That was the fundamental rule. But the bond in the Kiriyama family was absolute. It didn't matter that they were called thugs and lowlifes. They were thick as thieves. Furthermore, the bond between Mitsuru Numai and Kazuo Kiriyama was special. In a way, it had been Mitsuru who made Kazuo Kiriyama into what he was now. If there was one thing he knew that squares like Shuyanahara didn't, it was that Kazuo Kiriyama, at least until junior high, was no delinquent. Mitsuru's memory of his first encounter with Kazuo Kiriyama was so vivid it remained unforgettable. Mitsuru had been a bully ever since elementary school, but he was never needlessly cruel. Brought up in a typical, almost bland family, he wasn't particularly bright, nor did he display any other gifts. Fighting was the best way he could prove himself. Strength was the only standard he had, and he never fell short of it. So it was only inevitable, on his first day in junior high, he'd do his best to discourage the competition coming from other elementary schools in his district. Of course, judging from the strength of kids he'd encountered in the local hangouts, he knew that the local bullies from the other elementary schools hardly presented a threat. Not everyone might have heard of him, though. There should be only one king. That was the best way to maintain order. Of course, he wouldn't have thought to put it this way, but he knew this was what was going on. As expected, there were 2 or 3 competitors. It all happened after the entrance ceremony and class introduction, after school, when he was in the process of taking care of the last one. In the deserted hall by the art classroom, Mitsuru grabbed the kid by the lapels and shoved him against the wall. The kid was already bruised above the eye. His eyes were brimming with tears. It was a cinch. It only taken 2 punches. "Got it? So you don't mess around with me." The kid nodded his head frantically. He was probably just begging to be released, but Mitsuru wanted verbal confirmation. "I'm asking you, did you get that?" He thrust the kid's body up with his left arm. "Answer me. Am I the baddest guy in this school? Am I?" Mitsuru became irritated because his opponent wasn't responding. He lifted him up higher when he suddenly felt those eyes on him. He let go of the kid and turned around. The kid fell to the floor and scrambled away, but there was no way Mitsuru could go after him now. He was surrounded by 4 guys, all much taller than he. The badges on their collars indicated they were third-year students. You could tell immediately what they were. They were just like him. "Hey, kid," the pimply-faced one with a creepy grin said. "You shouldn't pick on the weak." Another one with orange-tinted hair down to his shoulders pursed his abnormally thick lips and said, "You've been naughty." His faggoty voice made the 4 of them crack up, laughing, "hee-hee-hee," as if they were all insane. "We'll have to teach you a lesson." "Yes, we must." Then they screeched again, "hee-hee." Mitsuru tried a surprise kick at Pimple Face, but he was immediately tripped by the one on his left. As soon as Mitsuru fell forward, Pimple Face kneed him in the mouth, knocking out his front teeth. The back of his head pounded against the wall that he'd just been using on his classmate. He felt dizzy. Something hot oozed down the back of his head. Mitsuru tried to get up on all 4s, but then the one on his right kicked him in the stomach. Mitsuru groaned and puked. One of them said, "What a fucking mess." "Damn," he thought. "Bastards. Fucking cowards. I could take on any of them if it was just 1-on-1. But there was nothing he could do now. After all, he'd been the one who deliberately chose a deserted place to intimidate his classmate. There wasn't a chance a teacher would appear. They pressed his right wrist against the floor. One of them carefully pried Mitsuru's index finger back and tucked it under his leather shoe. For the first time in his life, Mitsuru experienced real fear. "No, this can't be." It was. The sole of the shoe came down as Mitsuru's finger made a horrible cracking sound. Mitsuru shrieked. He'd never been in such pain. They kept laughing. He-he-he. Mitsuo thought, they're fucking insane. They're not at all like me. They're crazy. They were preparing his middle finger. Stop. Without an ounce of pride left, Mitsuo begged for mercy, but they ignored his pleas. He felt the sole of the shoe again, heard the crack of bone. Mitsuo's middle finger was ruined now. Mitsuo screamed again. Let's have one more then. That was when it happened. The door to the art classroom suddenly slid open. Can you guys keep it down? The voice was quiet. For a moment, Mitsuo wondered if it were a teacher. But a teacher would have intervened a lot sooner. And besides, a request to keep it down would have been strange. With his back still pressed to the floor, Mitsuo glanced over at the door. The kid wasn't too big, but he was incredibly good-looking. He was holding a paintbrush. He'd seen him at the class introduction. He was one of Mitsuo's classmates. His family seemed to have recently moved here. No one knew who he was, but since he was quiet and appeared obedient, Mitsuo hadn't paid much attention to him. Given how refined his looks were, he probably came from a nice family. Someone like him would do his best to avoid fights, so he was nothing to worry about. But what was he doing in the art classroom? Probably painting. But wasn't that a little strange on the first day of school? The pimply guy went up to the boy. Who the fuck are you? He demanded. Who the fuck are you, first year? What the fuck are you doing here, huh? What was that you said? He knocked the paintbrush out of the boy's hand and the dark blue paint from the brush splattered against the floor. The boy slowly looked up at the pimply guy. The rest need a little explanation. The small boy beat up the four third-year students. They all ended up on the floor, semi-conscious and groaning. The boy approached Mitsuo. After looking him over, he only said, "You should have your hand examined at a hospital." Then he went back inside the classroom. Mitsuo gazed at the four bodies lying on the floor. He was completely stunned by something so completely unprecedented. He felt in awe of the boy, like a rookie boxer realizing he was doomed to mediocrity upon encountering a world champion. Mitsuo saw a genius. From that point on, Mitsuo served that boy, Kazuo Kiriyama. He had no need to acknowledge it. Kazuo Kiriyama had beaten up four guys at once when Mitsuo could have only taken them on one-on-one. There should be only one king, and those who weren't king should serve under him. He reached this conclusion a long time ago. The idea probably came from his favorite shonen manga magazine. Kazuo Kiriyama was a mystery. When Mitsuo asked how he managed to learn how to fight so viciously, he'd only respond, "I just learned." Kazuo would only ignore any further attempts to find out more. Mitsuo would then try to coax more out of him by suggesting he must have had a reputation in elementary school. But Kazuo only denied it. Then maybe he'd been a judo champion or something. Kazuo denied this too. Another odd point, Mitsuo learned later, was the fact that Kazuo had broken into the art classroom to paint the day they met. When Mitsuo asked why he did that, Kazuo only replied, "I just felt like it." This was how Kazuo's strange persona contributed to Mitsuo's attraction to him. Furthermore, the quality of the painting, depicting the empty courtyard as seen from the classroom, far exceeded the first-year junior high level. But Mitsuo never got to see this painting because Kazuo had tossed it into the trash after completing it. Mitsuo showed Kazuo around the small town, including the cafe where his friends hung out, the place he stashed stolen goods, the shady dealer who operated a small black market in the back of his store. Mitsuo's talents were in fighting, but he did his best to show him every place he knew. Kazuo always appeared calm. He came along maybe out of curiosity. Eventually he took on other upper-class students, bullies from other schools, or sometimes high school students. Without exception, Kazuo had them instantly writhing on the ground. Mitsuo was crazy about Kazuo. It was perhaps no different from the joy a trainer feels in training a champion boxer. Kazuo wasn't only strong, though. He was extremely smart. Quite simply, he excelled at everything. When they broke into the liquor store's warehouse, it was Kazuo who came up with the brilliant plan. Kazuo saved Mitsuo from numerous jams he got himself into. Since getting involved with Kazuo, Mitsuo never got arrested by the police. Furthermore, his father was supposedly the president of a leading corporation in the prefecture. No, the entire region of Chogoku and Shikoku. He was fearless. Mitsuo believed some people were destined for greatness. He thought, this guy is going to be someone so extraordinary I can't even imagine what he'll become. Mitsuo made him the leader of his gang, which continued to stir up trouble. Mitsuo only wondered once whether it was right to get Kazuo involved. Kazuo strictly prohibited. He never said so, but that was the vibe he gave off. Mitsuo and the others from visiting his house. In fact, it was a mansion. So Mitsuo had no way of telling whether Kazuo's parents were aware of their son's activities. He was concerned his gang might be a bad influence on Kazuo, who was so obviously well-bred. After thinking about it a lot, Mitsuo finally shared his concerns with Kazuo. But Kazuo only said, "I don't care. This is fun too." Mitsuo decided it was all right then. And so, he and Kazuo had been through a lot together, the king and his loyal advisor. Even though they were now in an extreme situation, killing the members of the Kiriyama family was out of the question. Other classmates? Killing them was possible, sure. After all, Kazuo himself had passed them notes. Mitsuo was certain Kazuo had already planned out a strategy to deal with the situation. He'd outwit Sakamochi and then escape. If he really wanted to, Kazuo Kiriyama could take on the entire government, no prob. These were Mitsuru's thoughts as he left the school and walked approximately 25 minutes southward. He saw only one person the whole time. The figure who vanished into the residential area southeast of the school was probably Yoji Kuramoto, male student number 8. That made Mitsuru nervous, of course. He'd already encountered the corpses of Mayumi Tendo and Yoshio Akamatsu lying outside the school when he left. The game was well underway. Mitsuru's priority was to get to Kazuo's rendezvous point as soon as possible. The others were irrelevant. What mattered was how his group would escape from here. As he moved south, Mitsuru became increasingly tense as the cover behind which he could duck and hide grew sparse. Underneath his school uniform, his entire body was drenched in cold sweat. Sweat oozed out of his short, permed hair and dripped down his forehead. A little bit further ahead, the coast curved right and left. Somewhere in the middle of the curve, a rugged reef extended eastward from the hill and sank into the ocean like a buried dinosaur, only revealing its back. The reef was much taller than Mitsuru, blocking his vision beyond it. Glancing at the sea, he saw islands and other small lights that indicated a larger piece of land beyond the dark expanse of water. This had to be an island in the Seto Inland Sea. That much was certain. Once he surveyed the area, Mitsuru crossed the border between beach and woods. Exposed under the bright moonlight, he walked toward the reef. He clung to the steep rock and began climbing. The rock was cold and smooth, and with his right hand holding a gun and his bags strapped around his shoulders, it wasn't an easy climb. Once at the peak, he found that the reef was approximately 3 meters wide and the beach spread out beyond the rocks. As he prepared to climb down the other side of the reef, a voice addressed him. "Mitsuru!" Mitsuru almost jumped. He turned around and raised his pistol. He sighed with relief. Then he lowered his gun. Kazuo Kiriyama was in the shadow of a bulging boulder. He was sitting on a protruding rock. "Boss," Mitsuru said with relief. But Mitsuru noticed 3 lumps lying at Kazuo's feet. His eyes squinted in the dark, but then they immediately widened. Bodies. The one facing up, glaring at the sky, was Ruhei Sasagawa, male student number 10. The one lying on his side, scrunched up, was Hiroshi Koronaga, male student number 9. They were other members of the Kiriyama family. The third one was wearing a sailor suit uniform, and because she was face down, it was hard to tell. But she looked like Izumi Kanai, female student number 5. There was a puddle under their bodies. It looked black, but of course Mitsuru knew what it was. If the sun were shining on them now, the color of this puddle would have been identical to the color of the national flag of the Republic of Greater East Asia, crimson red. Completely confused, Mitsuru began to shiver. What was this? This is the southern tip. Under his slicked black hair, the perpetually calm eyes of Kazuo looked up at Mitsuru. He wore his coat over his shoulders like a boxer draped in his robe after a fight.
What?
Mitsuru's trembling jaw made his voice shake. What's going on here?
You mean this?
Kazuo nudged Ruhei Sasagawa's body with the tip of his plain, but nice, straight-tip leather shoe. Ruhei's right elbow, which had been resting on his chest, traced an arc and splashed into the puddle. His pinky and ring finger disappeared into the puddle. They all tried to kill me. Kurinaga and Sasagawa both. So I killed them.
That can't be.
Mitsuru couldn't believe it. Hiroshi Kurinaga was a nobody who tagged along with the group, so he was all the more loyal to Kazuo. Ruhei Sasagawa was more arrogant, always putting up a front. Sometimes it got to be a hassle to stop him from picking on Yoshio Akamatsu. But Ruhei had been extremely grateful ever since Kazuo pulled some strings to stop the cops from arresting his younger brother for stealing. These two would have never betrayed Kazuo. Mitsuru caught a whiff in the air. It was blood. The smell of blood. The odor was far more intense than the smell of Yoshitoki Kuninobu's blood back in the classroom. The difference was in the quantity. There was enough blood splashed around here to fill a bathtub. Crushed by the smell, Mitsuru's trembling chin dropped. Come to think of it, it is impossible to know someone's true thoughts. Maybe Hiroshi and Ruhei were so afraid of being killed that they went nuts. In other words, they just couldn't deal with the pressure. They showed up here at the assigned location, but they tried to ambush Kazuo. But Mitsuru's eyes turned to the other corpse. Izumi Kanai, who was lying face down, was a cute, petite girl. She was the daughter of a town official. Of course, in the ultra-centralized, bureaucratized republic, being a town official or council person was just an honorary post without any influence. And although she wasn't in the same league as Kazuo, she probably came from one of the 5 richest families in town. She hadn't been stuck up at all, and Mitsuru thought she was kind of cute. Of course, given how different their backgrounds were, he wasn't stupid enough to get hung up on her. And now she was... Mitsuru somehow managed to say something. So, boss? Izumi, how about... Kazuo's calm, cold eyes stared at him. Intimidated by the look he gave him, Mitsuru searched for an answer on his own. So, Izumi tried to kill you, too? Kazuo nodded. She just happened to be here. Mitsuru hesitated, but then forced himself to believe what he said. Well, maybe it was possible. I mean, that's what the boss said. He spat out. I'm all right. I would never think of killing my boss. This game is bullshit. We're going to take on Sakamochi and those bastards from the Special Defense Forces, right? I'm totally up for it. Of course, they couldn't approach the school now because it was a forbidden zone. That was what Sakamochi had said. But knowing Kazuo, Mitsuru was sure he had already come up with a plan. He stopped speaking. He noticed that Kazuo was shaking his head. Mitsuru moved his tongue, which had now turned gooey, and continued. Then we're escaping? All right then, we'll find a boat. Kazuo said, listen. Mitsuru stopped again. Kazuo went on. I'm fine either way. Although Mitsuru clearly heard him, he kept on blinking. He didn't understand what Kazuo meant. He tried to read Kazuo's thoughts from the expression in his eyes,
but they just calmly shone in the shadow over his face.
Well, what do you mean you're fine either way?
Kazuo lifted his chin and pointed it at the night sky, as if he were stretching out his neck. The moon shone brightly and cast a gloomy shadow on Kazuo's well-defined face. He kept this pose and said, I sometimes lose track of what's right and wrong. Mitsuru was even more confused. That was when an entirely different thought occurred to him. Something was missing.
And then he realized what it was.
The Kiriyama family consisted of Mitsuru and Ruhei and Hiroshi, whose bodies were lying there, plus Sho Tsukioka, who was missing. He'd left before Mitsuru. So then why? Of course, Sho Tsukioka might have lost his way, or he might have been killed by someone else. But Mitsuru had a sudden feeling that the truth was more ominous than that. Kazuo went on. Like now. I just don't know. The sight of Kazuo going on like this seemed, strangely enough, sad. Anyway, Kazuo looked back at Mitsuru. Then, as if he were following a musical score that had suddenly switched to allegro, he began speaking rapidly, as if it were beyond his control. I came here. Izumi was here. Izumi tried to escape. I held her back. Mitsuru held his breath. That's when I tossed a coin. If it came up heads, I'd take on Sakamochi and... Mitsuru finally understood, before Kazuo finished talking. No, it can't be. He didn't want to believe it. It was unbelievable. Kazuo was the king and Mitsuru his loyal advisor. It was supposed to be about absolute loyalty and eternal service. Even Kazuo's hairstyle. Right around the time Mitsuru's broken fingers healed up, he'd been the one who insisted on it to Kazuo. It looks good. You look so bad, boss. Kazuo kept the hairstyle after that. It was a silly little detail, but for Mitsuru, it symbolized how close they were. But, Mitsuru finally realized, maybe it was too much of a hassle for Kazuo to change his hairstyle. He might have been too preoccupied with other stuff to fuss over his hair. Then there were other things he realized. Mitsuru had firmly believed his relationship with Kazuo centered around a sacred team spirit, when in fact Kazuo might have been in it just for kicks, or just... Just. Yes, just an experience. Just an experience to be had. No feelings attached to it whatsoever. Kazuo himself had once said, This is fun, too. All of a sudden, the one thing that had disturbed Mitsuru from early on returned full force. Mitsuru thought it wasn't such a big deal, so he'd done his best to ignore it all this time. Kazuo Kiriyama never smiled. Mitsuru's next thought might have been touching on the truth, and it always seems like a lot is going on in his head, which is probably the case. But maybe there's something incredibly dark going on in Kazuo's mind. Something so dark it's beyond my imagination. Maybe it isn't even something dark. Maybe it's just an absence. A kind of black hole. And maybe Sho Tsukioka had already sensed this about Kazuo. Mitsuru had no more time to think. He was completely focused on his index finger. One of the fingers broken that fateful day. On the trigger of the Valter PPK in his right hand. A breeze blew in and the scent of the sea mixed with the odor rising from the puddle of blood. The waves kept crashing to shore. The Valter PPK in Mitsuru's hand quivered slightly, but the school coat draped over Kazuo's back was already moving by then. There was a mildly pleasant rattling sound. Sure, it was different, but something about the pulse of bullets... 1,000 rounds a minute on average, resembled the tapping of an old manual typewriter you'd find in an antique store. Izumi Kanai, Ruhei Sasagawa, and Hiroshi Kuranaga had all been stabbed, so these were the first gunshots to echo through the island since the game began. Mitsuru was still standing. He couldn't see under his school uniform very clearly, but there were four finger-sized holes running from his chest down to his stomach. His back, for some reason, had two large can-sized holes. His right hand, holding the Walter PPK, was trembling by his waist. His eyes